Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour, stories and articles about the American West, produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading articles from Cowboys and Indians magazine. Ryan Bingham Rising. The bull rider turned Oscar-winning songwriter turned breakout Yellowstone star is living proof that wild hearts can't be broken. "I'm still flying by the seat of my pants," he says. "A lot of this is just rolling the dice and seeing what happens." By Kate Nelson. Photos by Chris Dickinson. Ryan Bingham is finally having some fun. Don't get me wrong, the 42-year-old musician and actor has always had a roll-with-the-punches kind of attitude. It's just that life has thrown him more than his fair share of punches. These days, he's feeling comfortable in his own skin and taking it all in stride. The latest chapter in the wild ride of his life is, of course, his standout Yellowstone role as Walker, the Dutton Ranch's down-on-his-luck, up to no good ranch hand, who everyone loves to hate, or loves to love, depending on your stance. In many ways, Bingham and his character have a lot in common. They've both been shaped by their tumultuous, traumatic pasts. They've both spent years as drifting vagabonds. They've both got ranching skills aplenty. And they both carry around a guitar for when the mood strikes. But that's where the similarities end. Unlike ex-felon Walker, Bingham has never done hard time, though he did find himself in a jail cell in his teens for hanging with the wrong crowd. Plus, his grandmother once told him she was surprised he wasn't in prison. Yellowstone gives me an opportunity to be myself in a lot of ways, but my character is definitely more cocky than I am, he says with a laugh. Personally, I'm a little more on the ranch's home team and less conflicted about the things going on there. How Bingham landed his role has become part of Yellowstone lore, one of many tales about mastermind Taylor Sheridan's un-Hollywood approach to showrunning. Originally, Taylor contacted me about writing some songs for the show, he explains. Then when he discovered my family ranched and I used to ride bulls, he said, "Well, shoot, we got to get you in the show. If you're good, we'll keep you on. If you suck, we'll kill you off. I'm not dead yet." As Yellowstone fans know, Walker has had a couple of close calls with fate, but has had some serious staying power. That works out well for Bingham, who's gotten a new lease on life thanks to working on the show. "I really love staying in Montana for the summer while we shoot and just being in one place," he says. "While out touring, I spend so much time in big cities and on concrete. Yellowstone really gives me a chance to slow things down. It helps me get back to horses, back to nature, back to seeing food grow out of the ground and what it takes to do that." Although he has incredible respect for the seasoned actors he gets to work with and learn from, Kevin Costner, Luke Grimes, Kelly Riley, and Cole Hauser, to name a few, his favorite co-stars might just be the horses. "I grew up in the country, and I love being out in nature and getting to work with horses every day," Bingham says. "That's definitely in my blood and something I really appreciate about the show. Working with horses is a very humbling thing. They're so strong and powerful, yet at the same time such empathetic, sensitive creatures." His partner in crime for much of season 5 was a big gray gelding named Ironside. "He's a big old guy and just a sweetheart. I absolutely fell in love with him," he says. "I roped off him a lot, and I did all the branding scenes on him. He really took good care of me and was super calm and gentle with all the noise on the set." For inquiring minds who want to know, like me, Bingham explains that ranching and writing experience isn't a prerequisite for being on the show. Yes, they film on real ranches and real livestock, and real ranch hands help out on those scenes. But not all actors come in with that know-how. I feel lucky that I had the experience growing up, but some of the other actors have never been on a horse in their life, he says, naming Jefferson White, who plays Jimmy, as an example. I have a lot of respect for them because they get out there and work hard at it. It's been fun to watch, and you can tell it's filling up their souls in ways that the big city can't. For Bingham, Yellowstone feels like home. Born in New Mexico, he spent his childhood drifting through California and various parts of Texas, never in the same spot for more than a year or two. Having lost their ranch, his unpredictable alcoholic parents uprooted his family time and again in constant pursuit of work in the oil fields. As a result, Bingham felt like a perpetual outsider. He found some stability in the rodeo, where he started riding steers at age 11 at the urging of his uncle, a professional bull rider. Soon enough, he was making some money and breaking some bones. It wasn't until his later teens that he picked up a guitar, a gift from his mom, and learned to strum a few chords thanks to a mariachi neighbor. Pretty soon, he was writing his own songs and playing at dive bars, bowling alleys, backyard barbecues, anywhere that would have him. Once that started bringing in a few hundred bucks a pop, he could leave his manual labor side gigs behind. The guitar granted him freedom in more ways than one. Financially, it allowed me to work for myself and gave me the opportunity to travel to places I probably never would have had an opportunity to see, Bingham says. Emotionally, it gave me an outlet for a lot of things that needed to come out and that I needed to process. That really freed up my soul. And there's a lot to process. The nomadic nature of his youth that left him without a true sense of belonging. The rough-and-tumble life of a rodeo rider and a budding musician on the road, and the untimely deaths of both his parents, his mom to alcoholism and his dad to suicide. The earlier of his seven albums lean more autobiographical, to devastatingly beautiful effect. These days, his music is certainly still cathartic, but often serves to help him process the world around him, rather than the world inside him. For instance, his most recent album, American Love Song, touches on pressing topics like political division and gun violence. The kind of raw authenticity has earned Bingham a dedicated fan base who are drawn to his genre-bending sound that encompasses country, folk, blues, punk, rock and roll, and everything in between. Which makes perfect sense when you consider his wandering life story and his early influences. Muddy Waters, Bob Dylan, Woody Guthrie, the Rolling Stones. At first I was writing songs that were more or less just for myself, he says. But then I'd hear from fans how they'd connect with the songs. That made me realize how much we as human beings have in common through the emotional roller coaster of life. He still holds some music close to the vest. The thing about writing and recording music is that it stays around forever, he says. If you don't want to relive that memory you're expressing, you'd best not record it, right? There are certain very personal songs I choose not to share. Not everything is meant to be put into the world, and I'm very still protective over it. It's a sacred thing for me. Bingham had no choice but to embrace the spotlight when his song, The Weary Kind, co-written with T-Bone Burnett for 2009's Crazy Heart, won him an Oscar, Golden Globe, Grammy, and Critics' Choice Award. I was touring around the country in a van with my buddies playing bars and honky-tonks. Then all of a sudden, I'm at the Oscars, wearing a tuxedo. Afterward, the floodgates just opened up to opportunities, introductions, and different projects. That's led all the way up to Taylor Sheridan and working on Yellowstone. It's a life-altering thing. Of course, that doesn't mean it was easy. It was very overwhelming and surreal, Bingham says. I wasn't ready for it, even on a maturity level. I was pretty young, in my early 20s, and there were a lot of things I was still trying to figure out personally. Then you put in front of millions of people, and people are saying all these things about you that you're not even sure are correct or true for yourself. It humbled me and made me grow up in a lot of ways. That prompted a flurry of new fans who weren't necessarily familiar with his definition-defying sound. A lot of older people would come to our shows expecting this sit-down acoustic folk singer. They didn't realize we were a rowdy punk rock cowboy band, but for the most part, people have really been open to letting me explore different sounds and throw different types of songs at them. That's been pretty cool. Although there's still a familiar forlornness to his music, he's learning to embrace some levity, another expected result of working on Yellowstone. When it comes to acting, I get to play Taylor Sheridan's character and just have fun with it, he says. I've been able to take that and really lighten up on the music side. I've realized it doesn't always have to be so heavy. When I was younger, everything felt like life or death. I think I've settled into myself in a little older age, and I'm a lot more comfortable with the business and how it works. I'm just having fun with it. That sense of ease is apparent as Bingham and I are chatting ahead of soundcheck at the first of his 2023 concerts at Denver's Mission Ballroom. Rather than playing at any venue that will take him, like the early days, now, thanks to the incredible reach of Yellowstone, he gets to play the shows he wants in front of ever-growing crowds. The diehards still turn out in droves and educate the newbies about his vast, varied music catalog, proving there's plenty more to the real man than his TV character. Those longtime devotees were also a driving force behind his latest venture, an eponymous spirits company whose Bingham's Bourbon hits this year. While it might seem like a departure, it's actually a natural fit. At one of my very first gigs in a tiny little Texas bar, the owner told me, "Kid, if you can keep people buying drinks, you'll always have a gig here." So in a way, that made me think as long as people are drinking and enjoying themselves, I'll still have a job. Bingham has been intimately involved in developing the whiskey, taking cues from his travels to destinations like Ireland and Scotland to perfect the flavor profile. To honor his roots and his biggest fan base, the bourbon is made in the Lone Star State, using exclusively Texas-grown rye, wheat, barley, and corn. As Bingham explains, it's quite literally the distilled spirit of Texas. Although his plate is plenty full these days, he's finally in a place where he's only doing the work he wants to. That leaves some room for favorite activities like riding his horses and surfing near his California home. "Not everything has to be about the money," he says. "There's got to be something more to it, like integrity and passion. When it comes to writing songs, you have to be careful about what you write because you might not want to sing it when you get out there on stage. I try to approach everything with that mentality and make sure it's something I really want to be doing 10, 20 years from now." Lest this sounds like Bingham has crafted some sort of master plan for life, rest assured he's still just going with the flow and honoring what the universe puts in front of it. "I'm still flying by the seat of my pants," he says with a laugh. "A lot of this is just rolling the dice and seeing what happens." That blow-with-the-wind attitude serves him well on Yellowstone, where Bingham is on a need-to-know basis, meaning he doesn't know the outcome of the cliffhangers or plot twists any more than avid fans do. "My character's not privy to a lot of information, which works well for me," he says. "Even when you think you know what's going to happen, after a few days of filming, they might come back and say, 'We're going to redo that and write something different.' So you never know until it's all edited together. I enjoy not knowing. It makes it more fun to watch it when it comes out." After a lifetime of turbulence, it seems Bingham has started to embrace the uncertainties and actually enjoy the wild ride. He's found his place in the world, although he's still not in any one spot for too long, unless that's Montana while filming Yellowstone. And by all accounts, he's finally letting himself have a little fun. Where to go in this magical mountain mecca? Our Santa Fe Insider steers you to the classic, the cool, the new, and the unique by Wolf Schneider. It's a great time to be in Santa Fe. It's the year of Indigenous Celebration New Mexico, 2022, a big citywide celebration of the 100 years of India Market, 100th Gallup Intertribal Ceremonial, 85th anniversary of the Wheelwright Museum of the American Indian, and 60th anniversary of Institute of American Indian Arts. It's such a big deal, it's got its own website, IndigenousCelebration22.org. But it doesn't take a mega celebration to make travel to the city different, super special. Here are just some of the memorable experiences that make Santa Fe one of our favorite places in the West. 21 Super Santa Fe Experiences. 1. Immerse in the market. Santa Fe in August is all about Indian Market. This year, market is August 20 to 21, with lots of events swirling around those dates. Some of the highlights: making history, celebrating 60 years of the Institute of American Indian Arts and 50 years of the IAIA Museum of Contemporary Native Arts anniversary dinner and auction for scholarships at La Fonda on August 17th. Southwestern Association of Indian Arts Best of Show Ceremony and Luncheon on August 19th. The SWAIA 100th Anniversary Gala on August 20th. And the SWAIA Indigenous Fashion Show on August 21. 2. Go to the Artist's Way. Any time in Santa Fe is art intensive, but during Indian Market, everything amps up. The gallery-oriented satellite art fair, Art Indigenous Santa Fe, modeled after Art Basel, takes place at El Museo de Cultural on August 18 to 21. Participating galleries include Blue Rain Gallery, Chiaroscuro Contemporary Art, and LA's Trota Bono Contemporary. Blue Rain Gallery mounts a Native American group exhibition on August 18 to 22, with a reception on August 18 from 5 to 8 p.m. A solo show for Preston Singletary follows August 19 to September 3, with a reception on August 19 from 5 to 8 p.m. Manitou Gallery holds three shows: Palace Jewelers, its annual Native Jewelry Trunk Show on August 18 and 19 from 5 to 8 p.m., J.D. Challenger in person on August 18 from 5 to 8 p.m., and Overland Joe on August 19 from 5 to 8 p.m. Sorrel Sky Gallery features Ray Tracy, Ben Nighthorse Campbell, and Kevin Redstar on August 19th. Reception from 5 to 7:30 and continuing through August 21. King Galleries presents Legacies, a group show of Native artists including Tammy Garcia and Autumn Bortz Medlock on August 19, 3 to 5 p.m. Chiaroscuro Contemporary Art holds an Indian Market group exhibition and solo show for Emmy Whitehorse. 3. Quaff a classic cocktail. The Bell Tower Bar at La Fonda on the plaza offers great drinks and great views of Indian Market and all of the plaza. 4. Get interactive. See for yourself why the unforgettable art installation Meow Wolf was just named number 3 in the live events category for Fast Company's list of the world's most innovative companies. 5. Hit the trails. The city different. It loves its trails. There's the Margarita Trail, the Green Chili Cheeseburger Trail, and of course, there are actual amazing hiking trails. If you do all three, just make sure the margs come last. 6. Have Christmas year-round. Christmas is what you say if you want both red and green sauce on your New Mex food. That's how we love it. But then, we totally love Christmas. Speaking of, if you happen to be in Santa Fe during Christmas season, it's extra enchanting bathed in the light of the ubiquitous luminaria. 7. Soak it off. Get in hot water and relax your cares away at the 10,000 Waves, a Japanese-inspired spa, or Oho Santa Fe Spa and Resort. If massages and treatments are your relaxation-slash-wellness jam, Santa Fe obliges with many other top-drawer spas. 8. Take a tour. Walk, eat, photograph. This city has tours for every taste, including the Savor Santa Fe Food Tour, David Hopman's two-hour photo tour and class, 4x4 Mountain Adventures, and Alan Hauser Sculpture Garden Tours. 9. See the Miraculous Staircase, a former Roman Catholic church that's now a museum. Loretta Chapel is home of the famed helix-shaped spiral staircase that the Sisters of Loretto believe was built by St. Joseph. 10. Go gallery hopping. Take a pleasant stroll along Canyon Road, a lovely landscaped arts district of more than 100 galleries and boutiques. 11. Meander among the museums. Museum Hills boasts the Museum of Indian Arts and Culture, the Museum of International Folk Art, the Wheelwright Museum of the American Indian, and the Museum of Spanish Colonial Art, and Museum Hill Cafe, where the views from the outside patio are as gorgeous as the art in the museums. Back on the plaza downtown, make time for the exhibition Honoring Tradition and Innovation, 100 Years of Santa Fe's Indian Market, 1922-2022, which runs August 7th through August 31st, 2023, at the New Mexico History Museum. 12. Be Botanical. At Museum Hill, stop and smell the pinyon at the Santa Fe Botanical Gardens, where you can explore orchards with perennial borders, roses and lavender, meadow and xeric garden, raised beds for annual crops, and an extensive collection of plants with traditional uses, natural areas showcasing native plants common to the community, and from July 28th through August 14th, Shakespeare in the Garden, presenting The Comedy of Errors. 13. Peruse the plaza. Yes, it has four sides, but it's the entire north side of Santa Fe's Northtown Plaza that's of special interest. There, you'll find the Palace of the Governors, built in 1610, and the oldest continually occupied public building in the country, now housing the New Mexico History Museum. But it's what's under the shaded adobe facade that draws the most visitors and shoppers. In this portal, you'll find a rotating selection of artisans from various pueblos throughout New Mexico, selling their authentic creations as vetted participants in the Native American Artisans Portal Program. About the only time you won't find them there is when the space is taken up by Indian Market. 14. Check out the church. The Basilica of St. Francis of Assisi really is the cathedral different. You can't miss it. Not only is it the most visible thing in town, it's also oddly unfinished, missing two originally intended spires above the bell towers. 15. Contemplate O'Keeffe. If you can't make it out to her former home and studio in Albuquerque, Georgia's namesake museum in Santa Fe spans the 6 decades of O'Keeffe's artistic career with rotating exhibitions of its collection. 16. Live history. El Rancho de las Golondrinas, 200-acre living history museum, represents various time periods in New Mexico. 17. Make tracks to the rail yard. The 50-acre rail yard arts district offers shopping, dining, contemporary art, entertainment, green space, pedestrian promenade, and the all-important super fresh Santa Fe Farmers Market. 18. Be with the birds. On the 135 acres of the Randall Davy Audubon Center and Sanctuary, you'll encounter striking landscapes, wildlife, hiking trails, guided bird walks, and tours of the home and studio of American painter and art educator Randall Davy, known for his portraits and equine paintings. 19. Take a break in Tusuki. Founded in 1740, the Spanish village of Tusuki sits just north of Santa Fe, a few miles south of the current Pueblo. Today, some rich and famous call the otherwise unassuming village home. Eat at the iconic El Nido and or the long-standing casual neighborhood hang Tusuki Market and hope for an Ollie McGraw sighting. 20. Day trip to Taos. The scenic byway to Taos goes both high and low. The high road winds through the Santa de Cristo Mountains, and the low road winds along the Rio Grande. In the fall, the aspens are changing. Sublime. 21. Shop, relax, repeat. This town has an embarrassment of riches when it comes to great shopping for everything from turquoise and textiles to boots and buckles. Some of our favorite stops include Samsville Gallery, Rocky Gorman, Maloof on the Plaza, Sunwest on the Plaza, Sorrel Sky Gallery, Maya Gallery, Suzani, Nathalie, Rockbuster, Santa Fe Gold Works, and Barbara Michael Fine Art.
Hello, this is Michael, and I am reading from True West Magazine, April 2023 edition. Rowdy Cowboys, Outlaws, and Blood Feud by Kenyon Bennett. L.R. Milliken's life in Lampasas, Texas was both lucky and legendary. Lampasas, for a time, was on the edge of a lively frontier in Texas, and much blood spilled as that border exhaled dust and stampeded westward. Rowdy cowboys, outlaws, and others shooting up saloons was commonplace on the frontier. Lawlessness, always ready to emerge, leveled its Winchesters and six-shooters at the innocent, guilty, and unwitting. Gunsmoke lifted, and the targeted lay wounded or dead. Leander Randon L.R. Milliken lived in Lampasas as a teenager and young adult, having been born in Milliken, Texas, August 27, 1853. When he became the youngest deputy sheriff in Lampasas in September 1872, he had already earned a reputation for being even-tempered, responsible, and fearless. He had a strange power over bad men. They seemed to wince and cower under the steady gaze of his unflinching gray eyes. He was afraid of no man in the flesh, family friend Buren Sparks once observed. Life circumstances shaped Milliken. During the catastrophic yellow fever epidemic of 1867 in East Texas, Milliken's family had fled Milliken, a town established by their ancestors, and headed to Lampasas to escape death. J.W. Weaver, Milliken's stepfather, who died en route, was buried along the way. Milliken's mother, Marcella, succumbed on December 16th after reaching Lampasas, where her sister Amanda Nichols lived. Nichols and her husband, Lorenzo D., then helped raise L.R., age 14, and his younger brothers, Marcellus and Wilbur. Milliken sought employment as a teenager. he delivered mail as an outpost express rider, warily watching for Comanches on the route between Lampasas and Austin, and then worked as a young cowboy on John Sparks Ranch in Lampasas County. While Milliken earned a living, William Lewis Lou Schroyer of Lampasas County did the same. In 1870, Schroyer was a local 26-year-old stock raiser, the U.S. federal census indicated. His wife was named Mary. By October 1873, the young family had two sons, and by 1876, Schroyer was a wanted outlaw. Milliken and Schroyer crossed paths in Lampasas. A Christmas to Remember. When December 1871 galloped into Lampasas County, the residents celebrated the holiday season. Celebratory events brought much more than the usual good tidings of great joy. This became the Christmas to Remember. The festivities began Christmas Eve with whiskey drinking and firing of six-shooters and Winchesters on the streets, and the popping of firecrackers by the kids. All night long, and the next 2 days and nights, this racket was kept up, the Lampasas Leader reported in a retrospective on December 30th, 1898. Weaver's Saloon, the center of attraction, became riddled with bullets during the hijinks, but surprisingly, nobody was harmed, the leader said. Tillman Till Weaver, the owner of the saloon, was Milliken's step-uncle. Milliken prevented misdeeds from escalating during the 1871 Christmas Eve program held upstairs in a two-story, two-room rock structure. Milliken escorted his cousin, Albina Nichols, and Vic Bradford, a Nichols brother, to the Yuletide event. Festivities included music, conversation, flickering candles, and neatly wrapped gifts. Drunken Ben Harrell, probably a likable young man, but possibly amused by the absurdities that freely imbibed alcohol rendered within his brain, was primed for target practice, whether indoors or outside. The Christmas chairman began distributing gifts, and Horrell, wanting to shoot out candle flames, bellowed, "Throw the candles out the window!" The Horrell brothers could be wild and were fighters. Originally held in good standing in Lampasas, events, choices, and the fight for survival possibly drove some of the brothers to lawlessness in subsequent years. Milliken quickly snuffed out two candles and escorted Nichols and Bradford to the stairway, quietly urging them and others to leave. Horrell loudly bawled more directives. Milliken, using a ploy involving the recognition of good manners, asked Horrell for assistance to keep the young men back, so that older men, women, and children could exit down the narrow stairs first. Seemingly eager to help, Horrell bounded over wooden benches, knocking them aside. After the building had been emptied, Horrell demanded target practice. Milliken and Horrell now stood outside. Milliken threw a candle into the air, and Horrell expertly killed it, its brief life extinguished. The immediate danger dissipated after Horrell shot another candle. The 1871 holiday events continued merrily. Schroyer, highly spirited on Christmas Day, waved a six-shooter and rode his horse into a saloon. The revelers drenched the horse in alcohol, the leader said. More misdeeds occurred. A man named John West rode his horse into Dr. W. A. Frazier's drugstore. On Christmas night, the building, serving as the courthouse, inexplicably burned down on the north side of the business square. The county's early legal records went up in smoke. A youthful lawman. The ensuing months brought changes. On September 9, 1872, 19-year-old Milliken received his formal emancipation papers in Lampasas from Judge E.B. Turner, who had removed the youth's status as a minor. Justice of the Peace Thomas Pratt soon commissioned Milliken as a deputy sheriff. Sometime prior to Milliken's commission, Schroyer was in town for a friend's trial. A crowd gathered, expecting trouble. Reports of the event and words exchanged during the confrontation surfaced later. Sheriff Shadrach T. Denson, Shadrach, asked if anyone would accompany him to disarm Schroyer. No one volunteered, but finally a tall young man said, "I'll go." Milliken stepped forward without a gun, but would use something more effective. Carefully selected words, calm demeanor, and a level gray gaze. Dawson approached Schroyer and asked for his gun, explaining that trouble was developing and no one except a law official was to wear a gun in town. "Well, I don't know whether I will give up my gun or not," Schroyer said. Milliken then pointed to the gathered men and quietly explained to Schroyer that they were ready for trouble if it arose, although nobody wanted it. "Now, you can, if you will, do more to help us than anybody in town. All you have to do is lay aside your guns, get your crowd together, keep it away from whiskey to keep things peaceable. Otherwise, nobody can reckon the consequences," Milliken said. Schroyer eyed Milliken and Denson. "All right, boys, I'll keep my boys from making a fuss," Schroyer finally conceded. "We will stroll over, and I will leave my guns with old Uncle Till." He kept his word, handing his guns to Weaver in the saloon. As a nod to the pervading lawlessness and ruthlessness on the Texas frontier, consider Schroyer's premature death. Wild Bill Longley, Texas outlaw, befriended, shot, and killed Schroyer in Dry Frio Canyon, Uvalde County, January 10, 1876. Why? A bounty had existed on Schroyer. The Harrell Brothers. Milliken's life became entwined with some of the Harrell Brothers, Ben, Mart, Merritt, Sam, and Tom. Although they appeared to respect Milliken, on one occasion, one or more of them pilfered his horses. Milliken, alone, a pistol in his pocket, sought the Harrells and took back his horses. Milliken was part of a posse that searched for the Harrells and others following a series of March 14, 1873 shootings in Jerry Scott's Lampasas Saloon that resulted in the deaths of four state police officers. Authorities eventually captured and arrested Mart Harrell, James Grizzell, and Alan Whitecraft, for their part in the officer's death. Additional fugitives remained elusive. On May 2nd, the Harrells and a group of men broke Mart and others out of jail in Georgetown, Texas. Some of the Harrells and their cattle started for Lincoln County, New Mexico territory later in 1873. Disagreements tied to a faulty land sale to the Harrells, cattle sale proceeds, water rights, and racial tensions developed there. Ben's drunken spree on December 1, 1873 in Lincoln resulted in his death, triggering the ill-fated Harrell Wars in Lincoln County. By February's end, 1874, the beleaguered family had returned to Lampasas. The year 1874 was pivotal for Milliken. In August, he was converted at an old-time Methodist camp meeting, Cherokee Creek, San Saba County. On December 20th, he adopted Baptist doctrines and was baptized the following day. He was licensed to preach the first Sunday in February 1875. The First Baptist Church of Lampasas ordained him in February 1878. Shortly thereafter, Milliken married George Catherine Saunders on February 12, 1878, in Blanco County. Trouble dogged the Harrells. Cattle rustling charges arose more than once. On January 22, 1877, Pink Higgins sought Merritt Harrell in the Gem Saloon in Lampasas. "Mr. Harrell, this is to settle some cow business," Higgins said, fatally shooting him and igniting the lethal Harrell-Higgins blood feud. Lawman to preacher. The Harrells turned to Milliken, now a Baptist preacher. At the family's request, he officiated the burial service for Merritt. Milliken counseled the remaining brothers afterward, suggesting they embrace religion. Although expressing a desire to do so, they felt their lives had reached a turning point and a dark road lay ahead for them. The Harrell-Higgins feud blazed throughout 1877, climaxing in a deadly shootout June 7th in Lampasas. Major John B. Jones, commander of the Frontier Battalion of Texas Rangers, and his men were dispatched to Lampasas to provide order. Jones served as the intermediary to effect a peace treaty in late July, which the Harrells signed July 31st, and the Higgins faction on August 2nd. Lampasas held steady. Milliken, his religious pamphlets, and black frock flying, galloped his unruly horse westward in the early 1880s. With the horizon plainly visible within his serene gray gaze, Milliken, the cowboy preacher, increased his western flock. He established or financially stabilized Baptist churches in the Texas Hill Country, West Texas, and New Mexico. Ironically, preaching in a Pecos, Texas saloon in later years, Milliken converted a young man named James Samuel Harrell, son of John W. and Sarah of Lampasas. Milliken's human life ended April 18, 1938. The Harrells were part of his history and that of Lampasas. Kenyon Bennett researches in Texas and writes about Old West history. Her long-term projects focus on cattle drives and a circuit-riding preacher from Lampasas County, Texas. She is the features coordinator and journalist for the Democrat Tribune and the Dodgeville Chronicle in southwestern Wisconsin. True West Magazine, April 2023 edition. Tapped Out by Bob Bozbell. Tap Duncan versus Bill Hayes. Quote, "You can have Idaho, but you SOB's better not follow me to Arizona." A political rally is being held in Tucker's Saloon in Bruno, Idaho. After the speeches have finished, words are exchanged between two well-known local cowboys, Taplin Duncan and William Hayes. The two decide to go outside to settle their differences. As Duncan walks through the swinging doors, he hears a pistol being cocked behind him. Realizing he is about to be shot in the back, Duncan pulls his pistol and turns, shooting three times. Hayes gets off three shots himself. Duncan, described by a newspaper as an expert shot, fires three more times, hitting Hayes all three times near the heart. Hayes fires three times as well, hitting Duncan in the belt buckle, which slows the bullet as it goes under his skin and slides around to lodge in his back. Duncan, wounded in the gut, escapes, while Hayes attempts to run toward a door about 10 feet away, only to fall dead on the doorway step. Aftermath, odds and ends. A hearing was held at Tap Duncan's bedside on October 22nd. The court was led to believe that William Hayes called the defendant out with the intention of killing him and that the defendant did the killing in self-defense, and therefore the court ordered the defendant discharged. Justice of the Peace William C. Schneck recorded in his ledger. According to Duncan family lore, the dead man's son was being groomed to avenge his father's death. Duncan didn't want to kill a mere boy, so he went to the family and told them he was leaving the state, saying, as he left, "You can have Idaho, but you SOBs better not follow me to Arizona." Duncan purchased a new wagon to transport him and his wife, loaded their goods, and herded a string of saddle horses toward Arizona. According to Hayes family lore, Duncan stole the horses. After stopping in Wells, Nevada to fix the wagon, the Duncan wagon train crossed the Colorado River at Bonelli's Landing and headed into Arizona's Mojave County. Duncan often told the story that as the wagon train came through the towns of White Hills and Chloride, one of the cowboys would ride wide around the towns and meet the wagon on the other side. His name was Tom Ketchum. Duncan acquired a reputation as a promoter. He cut a deal to have Buster Keaton film five shorts on his ranch in 1925. Over the years, he received many visitors, including legendary writer Louis L'Amour, who claimed Tap Duncan taught him everything he knew about cowboying. Duncan was run over by a car just off Route 66 in Kingman and died in 1944. Recommended. Bruno, Then and Now, A History of Bruno, Idaho, 1811 to 2010, by Mary Hall Bailey, published by Caxton Printers. True West Magazine, April 2023 edition. Abilene, Kansas, by Peter Corbett. The once lawless cattle town is now one of the West's most historic Old West destinations. The railhead town of Abilene, Kansas, had a wide range and a wild range of characters vital to its prosperity on the frontier from the late 1860s into the 20th century. Abilene, 150 miles west of Kansas City, was a boom town from 1867 until 1871, when cowboys drove more than a million Texas Longhorn cattle on the Chisholm Trail to its stockyards. From there, the cattle were shipped by rail to eastern markets. Abilene was certainly one of the wild and wooliest towns in the West, said Julie Roller Weeks, Abilene Convention and Visitors Bureau Director. Some of Abilene's key figures included Illinois cattleman Joseph McCoy, father of the Texas cattle trade, who built Abilene stockyards. T.C. Henry, the town's first mayor in 1869, and Wheat King, who convinced area farmers to grow winter wheat. Lawmen Tom Bear River Smith and Wild Bill Hickok, who were charged with keeping a lid on the rowdy cowboys and drovers on Texas Street. Smith was killed in 1870 by a homesteader north of Abilene, and Hickok left town only to be fatally shot in a card game in Deadwood, Dakota Territory in 1876. Years later, Abilene's Dr. A.B. Seeley made a fortune in patent medicines. Charles Parker, the Carousel King, grabbed the brass ring, making amusement park rides and equipment. Of course, Abilene's favorite son was Dwight D. Eisenhower, 34th President of the United States and a leading U.S. Army general during World War II. Ike, as he was later known, was born in Denison, Texas in 1890, but grew up in Abilene. In a 1945 homecoming speech, he told the crowd, "The proudest thing I can claim is that I am from Abilene." Abilene celebrates its history makers, most notably at the Dwight D. Eisenhower Library, Museum, and Boyhood Home. He is buried there along with his wife, Mamie, and firstborn son, Dowd. The cattlemen, cowboys, and lawmen, and misfits of the West are remembered at Old Abilene Town, a 60-year-old recreation of Abilene's wild cowtown era when Texas Street was lined with saloons, gambling parlors, dance halls, and boarding houses. A new version of the Alamo Saloon has the back bar from the original Alamo. Visitors on the dusty streets and boardwalk of Old Abilene Town are entertained by can-can dancers and gunslingers staging mock gunfights. The Great Western Cattle Company building at Old Abilene has a 1/24th scale model of 1870s Abilene with 40 replica buildings. Wild Bill Hickok, although he didn't last long as Abilene's marshal, is still remembered here with the 78th annual Wild Bill Hickok Rodeo, set for August 1st through the 4th at the fairgrounds. Another Abilene attraction is Dickinson County Heritage Center, which features history exhibits, a telephone museum, and a blacksmith shop. Also, take a spin on a 1901 C.W. Parker carousel. Across town, tour the 1905 CD Mansion, built by Dr. and Mrs. A.B. Seeley. The family fortune came from selling Dr. Seelye's patent medicines across 14 states starting in 1890. The beautifully restored home includes a 1920 Steinway grand piano that resident tour guide Terry Tehens plays for visitors. Guests can also try their luck on a box bar bowling alley. If that's not enough, visitors can also track down a 24-foot spur outside Riddle's Western Wear, a dozen pairs of giant, decorated cowboy boots scattered around town, and the newest attraction, the world's largest belt buckle. You can't see it in all in one day, that's for sure, Roller Weeks said of Abilene's attractions. True West Magazine, April 2023 edition. You Can Never Have Just One, by Sherry Monahan. Cornbread and biscuits were staples of Southern cuisine in Arkansas. Biscuits and cornbread were staples in Arkansas homes, restaurants, and hotels. Early biscuit recipes called for cream of tartar or saleratus baking soda, until baking powder came along in the 1850s. Adulteration of all three of those products became a problem, and companies like the Royal Baking Powder proudly advertised that theirs was not. Biscuits and cornbread were frugal and fairly easy ways to fill empty bellies, and flour and cornmeal were readily available to Arkansas pioneers. In 1860, the Des Arc newspaper reported that a man who lived down east lived so long on cornbread that his hair turned silk, like what grows on the grain. They also noted his toes are so full of corns that he expects them to see them covered with husks the next year. Cornbread was typically made with cornmeal or a combination of cornmeal and flour and was leavened with baking soda or powder. But in 1877, Dooley's yeast powder suggested their product produce the most delicious and light biscuits, rolls, muffins, waffles, and even cornbread. It was available in general stores, as were cornmeal, flour, and sugar. In 1880, Reverend Mr. Wiley of Little Rock walked into the local tinner's shop to buy a coffee pot. After he made his purchase, he sat down on a bench used for cutting tin that had had a long knife on it. He lifted the coattails of his frock to prevent wrinkles. But when he stood to leave, he pressed the treadle and sliced off his coattails. He believed the tinner cut them off, and the devil made him do it. The tinner tried to explain, but the reverend swore out a warrant on the poor tinner. When they went to trial, the reverend explained his version of the story, and then the tenor took his turn. The justice was amused and asked the good reverend what was in his coattail pockets. The reverend told him that he had a bottle of whiskey and a pound of soda. The justice was surprised and told the reverend he wasn't supposed to have whiskey on him and that he must acknowledge that was prima facie evidence of his drinking. The reverend replied, "Well, I'll tell you, I got the whiskey for communion purposes. It's all right to talk about wheat bread and wine, but if you want to please my congregation, you have to spread out cornbread and whiskey, and plenty of it." He lost his suit and vowed to take it to a higher court and would not be fooled by a machine put in operation by the devil. In 1896, the W.W. Dickinson Hardware Company offered a Dickinson Cooking Bee biscuit baking competition to promote a new enamel range they were selling. The prime object was to show that the new Buck range was so easy to use that a child could operate it. The contest was open to girls ages of 6 to 14. They had 115 entries, with the youngest being 6-year-old Juliet Kettering. The girls took turns making their biscuits at Denison's, and the paper reported one little girl brought a bottle of buttermilk with her. She explained that buttermilk biscuits were the best, and she was afraid Mr. Dickinson would not have any buttermilk. The winner, Luella Percival received a toy version of the new Buck Range with a complete set of nickel cooking utensils. As a bonus, all the contestants were included as members of the newly formed Buck Little Rock Cooking Club. By the late 1890s, wheat and flour prices had risen, and a Little Rock newspaper wrote, "The high prices of wheat and flour are hard on the ordinary man, but it need not hurt anybody. Cornbread is palatable and nourishing and is reasonably cheap. Let's raise corn and eat cornbread." Recipe: Cornbread. 2 1/4 cup yellow cornmeal. 2 1/2 teaspoon baking powder. 1/2 teaspoon salt. 2 tablespoon sugar or molasses. 1 1/4 cup buttermilk. 2 tablespoons sour cream. 2 eggs. Combine the dry ingredients in a large bowl and stir to blend. Combine milk, sour cream, and eggs together. Add that to the dry ingredients and stir until blended. Pour into a hot, greased, 8-inch cast iron skillet or cake pan. Bake at 375 degrees for 20 to 24 minutes or until done. Recipe adapted from the Fort Smith New Era, December 1st, 1869.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.